Folks, this is Jack Spierko with another edition of the Survival Podcast. As always, one man's view of the changing world, the changing times, and the things we can all do to live a better life if times get tough or even if they don't. Today is, well, it is February the 6th. It's a Thursday, 2025, episode 3623 of the Survival Podcast. Out of the gate, because I don't know where you'll be listening to this, I'll tell you that I'm going to start doing something a little bit different going forward. That will not affect like 95% of the people in the audience, but about 5% of the people in the audience may really appreciate it. And that is, and if you're listening to it as a video, that's what I'm going to do. I'm going to start making the Thursday shows available on YouTube and probably Rumble. That's probably it. I'm not going to worry about all the other places because I can do that really, really easy. Now, here's the thing about it. That doesn't mean there's going to be a video of me producing it or anything. Like, these are, you know, we're going to have 7 segments today from people that aren't me. Some of them were prepared weeks ago, and they're just audio, and it's hard enough to get the expert counsel to stay on it and get audio files to me. I'm not going to start asking them for video. So it won't be a video. It's just going to be like the still image, the thumbnail, while you hear the voice. But, you know, somebody pointed out to me that, like, it would make a lot of sense if it didn't take a lot of work. And I'm like, well, how much work would it take for me to add that to what I'm already doing? And the answer is about 5 more minutes. Now, there are some things that are 5-minute things that I don't think really benefit me, so I stopped doing them, because if you do that, you know, 10 times a week, that's 50 minutes, almost an hour back in your life. That's kind of like cleaning up efficiency. But I think in this case, it might work. So if you like listening to content on YouTube, because a lot of people that are watching YouTube aren't watching. They're just like, that's, they can do that while they're multitasking. From now on, as long as it gets, you know, let's say 800 to 1,000 listens over a week, I'll keep doing it. It's worth doing it if it's kind of in that range. If it's like 56, well, then I'm not going to do it. And if you're one of the people that says you want it, not just listening to it there, but interacting, leaving comments, give it a thumbs up, do stuff like that, so that it helps me on YouTube, and I will keep doing it. So with that out of the way, what are we going to talk about today? So, Elon Musk and Doge marching through the institutions. That will be the segment from Dr. Ron Paul and Daniel McAdams at the Ron Paul Liberty Report for their highlights for us this week. Nick Ferguson will talk about moving a tree that was already planted in the ground to a new location. Andy McCann will talk about working out at home using just your body weight or maybe some simple equipment. He has a little resource for you on that and some advice. Joel Riles from Fortress Canine and Canine Academy will talk to you about, should you spay or neuter your dog? I have some thoughts on this. It's making me rethink my view on this for male dogs. I've always been like, if you're not going to breed your animal, then it makes sense to spay or neuter. I'm not so sure anymore. And I have 2 dogs to draw experience from. And I'll kind of add on to after you hear Joel's comments on dogs and dogs becoming more or less aggressive when spayed or neutered. Chef Ken Daniels will talk about making haggis for something called a Robert Burns dinner. This is on me. You snooze, you lose. Or in this case, I snoozed and you lost. Robert Burns dinners are done on the 25th of January. I got this from Ken on like the 23rd of January. So I don't know that it would have been that helpful anyway. But I thought it was an interesting segment. I don't listen to the segments as they come in. I make episodes every Thursday for expert panel, and I work with what I have. So I did not I didn't screen that one until today, and I'm like, crap, but it'll be interesting. I don't know if I'm going to be making haggis, but a Robert Burns dinner sounds kind of cool. Maybe I'll do it next year. And no one enforces things like when you do things. If you want to do something, you can do it. Have fun. Jean Pugliano will talk about how to roll an old 401k into an IRA and why you should. And options other than a 529 plan when you're saving money for your kids. I'll have some add-on on this because I'm going to put it very bluntly. John will never put it this way. Your kid could be an asshole. Okay? Like, you don't know. Every asshole used to be a kid that wasn't an asshole that turned into an asshole. And I don't want to insult your kid, and I'm not saying it's going to happen. I'm saying that when you make plans for somebody's future, you need to have in the plans all the contingency, and being an asshole or being irresponsible are both possibilities. So the idea that you would have a big hunk of money that a kid could just use any way they want might not be so good. And a 529, yeah, they have to use it for school or they have to pay penalties, but maybe they're willing to pay the penalties, or maybe they don't want to go to school. Maybe they have another way they want to go. So I think there's a lot of ways to do this that are better for everybody involved, including your kids, if you want to invest in their future in a way that has a contingency plan for, it turned out my kid was either irresponsible, a jerk, an asshole, whatever. Like, and again, I know some of you are like, not my kid. You don't know. You don't know. And I would put it this way. There is no way in hell it would have made sense to give Jack Spirico a big hunk of money at 21. 31, it would have been really good. Yeah? Just saying. Even me, right? Doc Bones will talk about setting up to have IV fluids at home if you have the training to do so. I'm going to have a little add-on in this one about the value of companies that will come do it. The person asking the question said, it's not really available where I am. I'm going to tell you it makes a good sense to find out if this type of service exists where you are, who the companies are, and have that as part of that documentation package we talk about for emergency preparedness from time to time. And then I am going to tell you a little bit about some stuff I've learned this week. I've been doing this AI challenge with Josh Hale that we talked about last week. I signed up for it, paid. I mean, I'm not a free student or anything. I'm not a freeloader. And it's all on ChatGPT. But things that often happen when they're interactive. And in this challenge, he's giving us a different prompt every day to drop in a GPT and report on our results. And we're all communicating. All the students are communicating in a Signal private group. And that's kind of checking out the side of different ideas and things. And I finally started playing with Notebook LM. And I've put up two kind of still videos, I guess you call them, where it's really audio, but there's just a thumbnail, so you're not looking at a blank screen for both of them. One on AI, talking about AI, and one on Bill Mollison's permaculture lectures from the 90s from a PDF from Barking Frogs. It's pretty cool. And I'm going to talk to you about what I've learned by using this tool and a little bit more about the hesitancy that some people have. It's bad. It's big tech. I'm going to tell you a story of young Jack Spirico with a pager in 1996 and what he used to say about cell phones. Like I said, I was not perfect as a young man. Seldom is a young man perfect. Anyway, seldom is anybody perfect. But I mean, if where I am now was perfect, and it ain't, where I was then is really, really, really far from where I am now. That's called growing up in life. So as we grow, sometimes we learn things, and we try to share what we've learned as older men with younger men, and I'm hoping younger men are listening. And I'm really, you know, as I get older and older, one of the things I worry about, where do I cross over to becoming the Luddite versus trying to encourage the young person who shouldn't be a Luddite from being a Luddite? Anyway, with all that, let's go ahead and hear from our first expert panel member today. Though I do want to let you know about today's item of the day before we do that. That is Dynomyco mycorrhizal inoculum. This is a mycorrhizal fungi inoculum that you add to your plants when they're growing in the ground. I actually add it to my plants when they're being started as seeds for transplants on the way out. I add it right when they start to, as soon as you see the soil starting to move, because, you know, starting to pop up, that plant starting to come out, little pinky go in, drop that stuff in next to it, and that way you have an activated mycorrhizal fungi and a living root at the same time. The first association a young plant seeks is with mycorrhizal fungi. It wants it more than bacteria, other types of fungi, etc. It wants that association. If it doesn't get it early enough, it may never develop it. It basically, a plant born into scarcity goes into a survival mode, accepting that it will always be in scarcity. It has no reason to believe that what's not there now will ever come up. Now, I'm not planomorphizing, right? They don't think like humans. I'm talking about adaptive intrinsic characteristics through evolution. That a plant born into a sterile environment adapts to that environment as best that it can, and then sometimes it doesn't recognize help when it comes. So getting that inoculation done right when you're starting your seeds. And why are we talking about this week, last week? Plant lights, plant starting cups, you know, mycorrhizal fungi, metal garden beds, all of it, because it's the time. I know everybody thinks like gardening season starts in March or April. Yeah, but if you're going to start your own plants, or you need new beds put in, it starts today. So in today's show notes, we've got the Dynomyco mycorrhizal, the Barina plant lights, the 2-inch nursery pots, and the galvanized raised garden bed. So if you're listening on YouTube, there's a link right down there in the video notes. You can find all the stuff and all the other things you'll hear about today, including like a resource from Andy McCann. With that, let's hear from Dr. Ron Paul and Dan McAdams on Elon Musk and Doge marching through the institutions. I like that phrase.
The Democrats are still trying to figure out what was wrong with the campaign.
What happened?
What did they do wrong?
What happened?
Maybe they had the wrong issues or something.
Or the wrong candidate.
But they're coming in. The excuses are really very, very funny.
Yeah.
But right now, Elon Musk, he had a name for himself, though. You know, 4 or 5 years ago, the first time I heard of it, I said, is this guy real? Does he do this? And of course, since that time, he probably increased his influence 10 or 100 times, 100-fold.
Oh, yeah.
Because he's world renowned now. But he just happens to be a friend of Trump. And Trump has a job on his hands, but they're sticking together and they're doing a fair job and trying to follow some of the campaign promises. It's just that my only problem is some of his campaign promises wouldn't be exactly pure libertarianism.
Yeah, yeah.
But the one thing for sure, Trump and Musk are interested in not going out of their way to ridicule libertarianism. Matter of fact, if they see an opening, they'd just assume we'd be on their side.
Yeah.
And I think that's a sign of what's happening in the community around the country, maybe around the world, that we're witnessing something much bigger than anybody realized, and witnessing the failure, you know, of the progressive era. It's been going on for a long time, but it's been going downhill too. And this is, hope it's a climactic end, you know, to the assault on liberty that we've had. What? Medical care, education, morality in government, and all, the Department of Justice, privacy, all those things have deteriorated. So now we find out this bold guy by the name of Musk, he's in there, he's disrupting things. And you know what? The far left does not like him.
Well, you know, Elon Musk is a tremendous hate figure for the left, you know, and it's a lightning rod. And I almost think, given his interesting and peculiar personality, I almost think he actually enjoys it. The fact that just his presence, just his name causes them. It used to be Trump. I almost think that Musk has surpassed Trump, supplanted Trump as the target of hate on the left. And why do they hate him? Because he doesn't play by the rules that they themselves have made, right? They made all the rules, and he says, no, I don't think I'll follow those rules. And I think that makes them crazy. And he has the ability, partly thanks to his wealth, partly thanks to his stature in the business community, and partly just the strength of his personality, he has the ability to thumb his nose at them, and that drives them crazy. But the real question, and this, sort of our whole show today is based on this New York Times article, and Michael Schellenberger brought it to my attention, at least with a post on X, about Musk's, I would say, short march through the institutions, right? The opposite of what happened in China, in communist China in the 60s. This is a short march, and it's a very quick march. And the question, Dr. Paul, I think, is how do you make huge changes in government? How do you dismantle this edifice that has had plastered on year after year, layer after layer of bureaucracy? What is the right way to do it? And I think what's happening now, it's a lot of people in D.C. are flipping out. They're flipping their lids because he's doing it by going in there and just cleaning the stables, cleaning out the stables. The thing is that D.C. loves executive authority when it means waging wars without Congress participation, when it means adding more layers and more levels to government. They love executive authority more than anything else. The only time they don't like executive authority, and that's why Chuck Schumer and the others are absolutely flipping out, the only time they hate executive authority when it comes to doing the opposite, which is reducing government, cutting things that are not necessary, using the power that he has over the executive agencies to reduce what they do. All of a sudden, we've got too strong of an executive here.
Yeah, my add-ons to this are, and when I say left here, understand that I mean a lot of Republicans too. And I don't mean Republican voters. I mean Republican congressmen and senators. The Republicans are pretending to like this. Many of them hate this because they have just as much grift in this shit as the Democrats do. They really do. But they're in an odd position now. They can't say that. They have to pretend to go along with what's going on. So the biggest thing that's happened since this whole thing started with Elon Musk is shutting down USAID. Let me tell you, I really thought we'd hear more about that in this segment, and I bet you we will in the future from Dr. Paul, because eliminating America's regime change mechanism is a big thing to Dr. Paul, and USAID is the primary means by which regime change happens throughout the world. And let me tell you something that may be hard for some of you to believe, because you still think Russia's the big bad in the Ukraine conflict. In spite of the fact that it's our fault, we did it, and we did it going all the way back to about the year 1998, but we really did it in 2014. In 2014, there was a duly elected, democratically elected, legitimate winner of the Ukraine election. The United States intervened, caused what was called a color revolution, and had that election undone and put in their puppet. This is what started the whole shit out in Donbass. This is where those people said, no, we're not part of this anymore. They basically became separatists from Ukraine. We don't want to be part of you anymore because we elected somebody that took our needs into consideration, and you just changed it in a completely illegitimate manner. Where do you think the money that was used to ferment that insurrection, and that's a real insurrection, isn't it, in Ukraine came from? Do you think it came from A, the little guy on the Lucky Charms box, the little leprechaun on the Lucky Charms box, Tony the Tiger, USAID, or God? Who do you think gave all the money, had all the NGOs in place, had all the influence in place, funneled it in there, and fucked it up so bad the CIA abandoned their own operatives in Ukraine and said, good luck, guys, you're on your own. You know that we'll disavow you shit in movies you think is bullshit. No, that's what happened there. We had a dude on the show about 5 years ago tell us about it. He was there. And they said, yep, fuck you, you're on your own. Sorry. Good luck. Dude had to figure a way to get out of the country. He nearly got killed. That's what we do. And so the stuff about, you know, a transsexual musical in Ireland, right, or sex changes in Colombia, or whatever the fuck you're hearing about, that's the freaking tip of the iceberg in this shit. You know what came out today? Do you want to know what came out today? You know who else was getting money from USAID? 6,000 journalists and 7,000 newsrooms in America received USAID money. The government was paying the people to give you the news to tell you what the news is based on the government paying them. Free press, my ass. Pravda, out the ass. The illusion of multiple sources of news. We've all seen the things. They make it look like Brady Bunch or something, like where all the news people are saying the same shit. How do you think that happens? There was also, like, Politico was getting, like, $8 million, left-wing rag, getting $8 million a year, and something like there was a $500,000 worth of pro subscriptions for members of USAID for pro subscriptions to Politico. I don't know what a pro subscription gets you other than grifting, I guess. Like, here's another way we get, like, 8 million, you need 8.5, we got an idea. Hey, create a pro. Like, that's the shit that's being revealed. And the big thing is, and I'll tell you why, they said the left hates Elon more than Trump now. Yeah, and I'll tell you why. Elon won't go away. The left has made peace with the reality Donald Trump will be president for the next 4 years. I'm sure they'll try to impeach him. No one will care. It's not happening. It doesn't matter. He's going to go on with his life. But at the end of 4 years, he'll go away. And he'll be old enough and a former president, and mostly he'll go away. Elon Musk isn't going to go away, so they really hate him. But here's the other thing. President Elon, he's shutting down. President Elon doesn't exist, and he ain't shut down anything. Elon Musk has no power to shut down anything. All he has is access to data, and he's taking the data and making recommendations to the Trump administration, and the president of the United States is the one making the shutdown orders. He's the one with the power to do it. Elon doesn't have the power to do it. And no matter how many times they say it, that's not going to change. But they'll keep saying it. And the dumbest of the dumb among us, the people that walk among us, the people that are part of the democracy you love so much, they vote based on that stupidity, and they do it with willful ignorance. I'm more worried about what we can do in our own lives to change things for ourselves. So let's move on to something maybe more productive for that. Now we're going to hear from Nick Ferguson. You got some trees, they're in the ground, but now you're going to move. You don't want to leave the trees. You want to take the trees with you. Can you do it? Yeah, here's how.
Hey there, Nick Ferguson here with an expert counsel answer for Zeb on moving trees to a new property. And speaking of trees, we're getting close to sold out on all our new plant packs this year. I know we're sold out on one or two things, but there should still be a couple of strawberry packs, elderberries, bush cherries, and livestock feed packs over at rareplantstore.com. Let's get into the question from Zeb. He says, good morning, TSP expert counsel Nick or Jeff. What is the best way to move younger trees already in the ground to a new property as I'm selling my current land and moving? I'm in zone 8A, Georgia, and recently purchased a new property. I have put in younger trees over the past few years and would like to know the best way to move them and what would be the best time. I could also, could I repot some until I know exactly where I want them? Or would it be better to get them in the ground as soon as possible? Thank you for your work, Zeb. Right now, that's the answer. You're in winter right now. Everything should be dormant for you for a little while, hopefully. You need to get on digging those trees ASAP to get them transplanted into their new homes or temporary places. It's best to get them in the ground. However, if you don't know where to put them on your new property, potting them up is fine. You're just going to want to treat them with kid gloves this year, as the transplant shock is likely going to be an issue. Put them in kind of a nursery place, dappled light, not full blaring sun. If you can get them like 4 good hours of morning sun and then afternoon shade, that's going to help them since they're in pots. Make sure they don't dry out. Don't overwater them. Make sure you're still fertilizing. And when you're going to transplant them or dig them up, I suggest removing a third of the top of the tree to help in reducing transpiration loss. That's just basically you're pruning them back pretty hard. Also, I'd suggest getting yourself some Super Thrive to water them in once they wake up for the year. It's basically a fertilizer amendment. It's kind of like vitamins and stuff. I don't know why it works, but that stuff seems to really work. I like it. So, on to the details. When you're digging those trees, you're going to kind of, as like the radius from the tree, you're going to want to reach out pretty far. The trees, most of their roots should be in the top 2 to 4, maybe 6, 8 inches of dirt. So you don't have to dig down really deep, but you really should be digging out wider. So reach out in a circle around the tree fairly far to get as many of the feeder roots as you can. I'm talking like at least a couple to 3 feet out from the trunk. And that's going to get you as many of those feeder roots as you can snag. It's going to keep as much of that root system intact as possible, which is really going to help you have success as you transplant these. Make sure that when you're going to dig that the ground is nice and wet, as the moist soil will break apart easier and won't tear the roots. It's going to handle that a whole lot better than if the soil is dry, and it's going to lessen the risk of you damaging those roots just due to like the heavy soil ripping those little feeder roots off of the main roots. You're going to want to bundle the roots well in damp blankets or sheets. I like to use old sheets bought from thrift stores for stuff like this. You must keep the roots damp. If you're digging them up and you're going to dig up all these trees in one go, do not let them sit there in the sun and dry out. You will kill them. It doesn't matter if they're dormant. If you let those roots dry out, you're going to kill them. You want to keep as much of that root mass as you can keep, like I talked about. It's okay to gently rinse the roots off to remove the soil if it's getting too heavy. So if you're going to pot them up, you're probably going to want to give them a little bit of support, because if you're using like new potting mix or whatever, it's going to be really light and fluffy, and those trees, if they're a couple years old, are likely going to be kind of big. So I'd use a little bit of support. You can use those bamboo stakes or like 1x1 tomato stakes, or you can use fiberglass step-in posts. Any of those things should work. And I would use flexible ties in order to not choke the sapwood. Again, fabric works great, especially t-shirt type material, jersey knit fabric. If you can get some of those like thrift store, Goodwill, whatever, jersey knit bed sheets, then you know, you can cut strips out of those, just rip strips out of those, and you have really nice plant tie material because it's stretchy fabric. Again, keep them out of the sun, keep them cool and damp, and if you're transporting them in the back of a pickup or in a trailer, lay them all down and cover the branches and trunks with a tarp or fabric and tie it all down so that they're protected from wind. You can actually kind of like put them in bundles and then wrap a bed sheet or something around it or a tarp around it to protect them from that wind. They can actually get windburnt from highway speeds between the two properties. That's pretty much all I've got for you. I hope that helps. Like I said, get on it as soon as possible. You want to dig them up before they start breaking bud, because they're going to be trying to push a whole lot of new growth, and the chance of them bleeding too much as they're pushing sap is going to be a lot higher the later in the winter you wait. So hope that helps. I'm Nick Ferguson from Homegrown Liberty and RarePlantStore.com. Do good things.
Great stuff from Nick. Yeah, and if you want to start planting some more trees or some other really cool plants, bushes, shrubs, vines, just tons of really cool productive perennials. Nick has more this year than he's ever had before. You want to check him out again, rareplantstore.com. I would do that because my report back from him is that there really is dwindling inventory for 2025. Nick is not a year-round nursery provider. He does his sale every spring and then, you know, builds back up to sell the next spring because that's the best time to plant and that's when everybody wants to order. So if you don't get your order in soon, you won't be getting an order in, you won't be getting anything from Rare Plant Store, and you'll be sad. So don't do that. All right, next up, let's hear from Andy McCann on working out at home. And he's got a pretty cool little guide. Again, those of you listening on YouTube, click that link down there. You get over the audio side. All the resources, links, etc. will be available to you.
Hey guys, this is Andy McCann here with a health and fitness question. I got this the other day from Ofer, and he said, because it is really, really cold. And he's like, all right, basically, if I can't get out and do a thing, what can I do at home? Do you have that link to the 32 at-home workouts? The answer is yes, I sent it to him, but I want to give this to you guys too. On a cold day, or if you're not doing anything, this is just a great way to start. So I got two things I want to give you. One is, I'll provide the link to Jack and you guys can get it there, but you can also get it from my website. So it's 32 at-home workouts we put together back when you couldn't go anywhere for 2 weeks, which turned into a lot longer. And it's things you could do at home that don't really require any gear. Sometimes it may say, hey, grab like a jug of water, but it should be things, it's all body weight, it's all easy to do, it's all movements. You may say, hey, I don't really actually know what that means. I try to go back in there and answer and put some more things in there. But with my CrossFit brain, I may not remember what normal people don't know. So anyway, that's there. It's 32 at-home workouts. So more than 31, because if you want to skip something and, you know, you just don't have to do that workout, go pick another. Yes, they are kind of repetitive because they're body weight and there's only so many things you could do with your body. But at least you didn't have to think of it. A thing that you can do when you're never sure what to do is ask somebody and they will tell you, hey, this, and this is what I do for a living now. I used to be an electrical engineer doing technical sales, and now I help people with their body. So there you go. That's one of them. The other is, for you guys, if you go to crossfitgarage.com/TSPC, you are going to see some things that I've been giving to you guys that are easier to find. So it's got something about carnivore. It's got the 60 easy, those five categories, one a month, so 60, 12 times 5, that you can do over the year to become better, healthier, aiming for that longevity. There's another garagefitness.online, so you can get the link through this or go to garagefitness.online. And then, of course, my podcast, which is Fitness, Food, and Finances. But here's the thing I want you to understand or to know. One, you're not alone. Everybody asks this question. So the reason I use it from Ofer today is I get this question all the time. I go on other people's podcasts, and there's a local girl, Sue Becker, who does home ground bread. So basically, she'll sell you meals and grains and all sorts of other stuff and teach you. Anyway, I went on her podcast like 2 years ago, and I still get people asking for this 2 years later. Hey, send me that. So it's asked for a lot. It's easy to do. You could even go into ChatGPT and say, Chat or GP or whatever your name is, give me some workouts I can do here at home, and it'll probably generate for you. Also, you could say, I'm very immobile in squats, or I've got a shoulder issue. What can I do to strengthen it? It'll probably give you a good idea. If you don't want to ask chat, ask me. That's what I do for a living. So, guys, I'm happy to help. I'm happy to bring you free stuff. I want you to have a great life now as well as in the future. I want you to live a good life now when times are nice or even when they're not. So following Jack's whole motto of his, lifestyle design. So he wants to design that lifestyle. I want you to have a life to live in that lifestyle. Guys, if you need me, you can email me, andy@crossfitgarage.com. You can find me on YouTube at andymccann42. And the podcast is Fitness, Food, and Finance. All right, y'all take care. Stay warm.
So the link to the resource that Andy mentioned, again, is available in the audio notes for today's episode, 3623, as always, all resources in the audio notes at thesurvivalpodcast.com. Next up today, Joel Riles from Fortress Canine and Canine Academy, with a question that I would have answered differently prior to listening to this. So I'm going to shut my hole, play Joel, and then I'll come back and tell you kind of my change of opinion after listening to him. Based on personal experience, I'm just looking at it a little bit differently now.
Hello, TSP World. This is Joel Riles coming back at you from Fortress Canine and canineacademy.us. And today's question is from Tom in far, 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 far North California, is how he put it. And it's a question about whether or not to spay or neuter a dog. And he was asking for my thoughts on it. So, in general, the veterinarians will recommend spaying and neutering, and they will tell you that it is because it's healthier for them, and for a male dog, it might bring down their aggression. And in reality, the reason they've been conditioned to do this, just like many medical professionals are conditioned to do various different things, is because for quite a while, and to some degree even still today, there is a overpopulation problem with cats and dogs, right? Especially in the stray type situation. There's too many strays around. And so that's why spaying and neutering was pushed for a long time. And then they said, oh, well, you know, if you remove all their reproductive organs, they can't get cancer in them. So it prevents cancer. And they'll give you excuses like that. Here's my thoughts on it. Number one, every time I've asked a veterinarian, oh, well, these dogs that die of cancer from, you know, uterine cancer or testicular cancer or whatever it is that they supposedly get and die from, when do they die of that? Like how long do they live before, you know, they get this cancer and die? And they're like, oh, you know, around 11 or 12 years old. I'm like, well, for a German Shepherd-sized dog, 11 or 12 is pretty much their lifespan. And so at those ages, they're dying of something. And if it happens to be cancer, but they had a full long life, then the spaying and neutering didn't help them any. Now, here's my experiences with spaying and neutering. Number one, if you're going to do it, and there are some valid reasons to do it from an owner slash handler perspective, if you're going to do it, I recommend waiting at least 2 heat cycles on a female, if that's possible, or waiting till a male is about 18 months to 2 years old. The reason I recommend that is because they've fully matured at that point, right? All of their sexual maturation has finished, and they've matured. They're full grown pretty much at that point. One of the things you'll notice on male dogs, especially that were spayed too young, is they'll have very long, lean legs. That's because the growth plates in their legs don't properly seal when they've been neutered too early. On females that are neutered too early, often what happens is they put on a lot of weight, and even if you only feed them a little bit, they have a tendency to keep a lot of weight on. And so I recommend letting them fully sexually mature before you're going to do this. Now, why might you want to spay or neuter a dog? If you have a female, about every 6 months, she's going to come into heat. She's going to bleed for about 2 weeks, and then she's going to be in what we call full heat for about 5 days. It varies just a little bit, 3 to 7 days, say. In which time she's really going to want a male to breed her, and any males that are intact in the area are really going to want to breed her. So if you're in a situation where you're going to be around things like that, other dogs, and or you're in a situation where the bleeding that she's going to be doing is a big deal, then that might be a reason you would want to have your female spayed. For the males, there's really no physical benefit And my experience is it's about a 50-50 whether or not they become more aggressive or less aggressive after being neutered. I don't think that's because some people are like, because they're bad, because you cut their balls off. My experience is this. This is my personal experience. I had a lot of anger issues about 7-ish years ago, and you know, for about a decade before that, 5 to 10 years before that. And when I got tested for testosterone levels, I was really low. I started taking a testosterone supplement, and now my wife gets mad at me because I don't get mad enough at people that she thinks I should be mad at. So it has a very calming effect in the proper ranges, right? You can obviously go way too high, and then you can get like roid rage or whatever they want to call it. But you can also get really low in your testosterone levels, and that can cause problems as well. So when you neuter a male, if they are susceptible to having those issues with low testosterone, then that is very likely, or possibly at least, something that could happen, right? So for males, unless you just don't have the discipline to keep them around and your neighbors have females that are intact and they might want to run off and go breed them, as long as that's not your issue, then I would not neuter a male. And unless the heat cycle and the bleeding that's associated with that is a big deal for your females, then I also wouldn't get them spayed. Now, that's more of a concern for more people, right? The bleeding. The only other situation might be you have a male and a female, and you do not want them to breed, right? And in that situation, you might want to get one or the other, possibly both, but probably the female spayed, just so that when she does come into heat, you don't have to worry about it, right? Because if you're not Johnny on the spot making sure those two are staying separated, they're like horny little teenagers, and if they can make it happen, they will make it happen, and then you will have puppies. So those are my thoughts on spaying and neutering. I hope that that's been helpful for you. Hopefully that will help you make a good decision with the next dog that you get. Remember, if you have dogs and you want help training them, you can always check out Canine Academy at canineacademy.us or going to Jack's website, thesurvivalpodcast.com, and clicking on the Canine Academy banner there on the right side of his website. If you are looking to purchase a protection dog or to get a working line puppy that is a German Shepherd, Belgian Malinois, or a Dutch Shepherd, check out fortresscanine.com. We'd be happy to help you guys out. And until next time, remember to train hard and stay safe.
So, yeah, definitely the death from cancer thing at an average age of death anyway for the dog is something that, you know, I don't know. If we figure out protocols and we keep our dogs active and healthy and our average age starts moving up to like 14, 16, I know many dogs make that age. My black lab, Blackie, because my son, who was 7 at the time we named him, was so creative with names, he lived to be 16, and that was not typical for a dog of that size. He was also a mongrel, which tends to live longer. So if that became average, and these dogs were on average dying of these cancers at 9, 10, 11 years of age, then I might consider it a little bit differently. Here's my opinion, though. I have had a lot of dogs in my life, and only one wasn't neutered. Most of them were adopted from organizations that neutered them before we got them. The one that we had that wasn't neutered was a dog named Blackie. He was a black lab chow mix. And the only reason he wasn't neutered, we adopted him from the ASPCA. He had a dog cold, he had a nose run, runny nose, and they did not feel comfortable putting him through even a minor surgery, because doing this for a dog of that age, he was a pup. He was like 15 weeks old or something, 14 weeks old. Like, that's not safe, so they didn't do it. He was part of an abandoned litter, and he might have been like 8 weeks old. He might have just been weaned. He was a little tiny furball. Anyway, they said you can bring him back for it, and it's covered in your adoption fee, and we just never did, and no one ever asked, and we kind of forgot about it. And then we're like, hey, we're not doing it. Let him alone. He's fine. We didn't have a female dog at the time. So when I think about the male dogs I've had since then, Blackie was kind of an aggressive asshole dog, and he literally chilled out as he aged. Charlie, who is the dog I most recently lost, and I, for those that are new to the show, I loved that dog. I love all my dogs as family members. I loved him as a family member and a friend. He was that one dog you get if you're lucky in your life. I love the dogs I have now. They're great girls, man. One is from Joel. Her name's Belle, and the other one is a husky pit mix that we took off the street named Lucy. And they're great dogs, and I love them. They do not have that interaction that Charlie and I had. And it's not because of the lack of effort. It's just they don't have the mentality that dog had. He had a different level of understanding of interaction. I can't really explain it. My best friend David referred to him as a dog that was 10% human. I could communicate with him, unlike other dogs where you have to give commands to be very specific. I could literally give him two sentences of instruction in a conversational mode like I'm doing right now, and he would go do it. He would go do it so long that I have to remember I told him not to let the chickens on the porch. He's still 2 hours later on the porch not letting the chickens on, right? Like, hey, buddy, you're good now. Like, that's how that dog was. But he became more of an asshole as he aged. He was neutered. He was neutered. Blackie wasn't. Blackie chilled as his age. And I had another dog, a Siberian Husky named Lakota. He lived to be about 12 and a half years of age. He was neutered, and he was the same happy-go-lucky, goofy, dim bulb, except that he got old and couldn't be as energetic. Like, so I think he can go any way, but the idea now that maybe having like no testosterone as the animal ages backfiring on the aggression, when I think about how Charlie got more and more aggressive until he couldn't be more aggressive due to his decline, I think maybe there is something to that. There really was something to that, and it makes sense. Personally, with females, my opinion is that it makes your life easier if they are spayed. It just does. Making it, doing it a little bit older might be a good thing. Though you may find some vets don't want to do operations on dogs for females anyway, because it's a more involved surgery when they're over 60 pounds. But when they are in heat, it is a pain in the ass. They do make a mess on the floor. Like, it's problematic. And any male that can get to your girl will during that time, and she will hook up and they will make puppies. Like, you know it's going to happen. My dog, Belle, is from Joel, and she is one of the rare dogs that come out of Fortress Canine that is a cross between a Malinois and a German Shepherd. And the reason that happened, it was not a planned breeding. Her mother was in a kennel during her heat period and supposed to stay in that kennel, and she figured out how to open the kennel. She escaped, and she went and hooked up with Joel's personal dog, big old male Mally, and so she was just like, hey, I got this urge and I gotta go get it done. Like, there's a reason for that. It's survival of the species. So to me, you know, make your own decisions, but those are some experiences that I've had. Moving on, let's talk about haggis with Chef Ken Daniels.
Hello all, Ken here with DrinkEatLearn.com. Today's question comes from Graham. He asks, the boys and I are wanting to celebrate Burns Supper this January 25th. They think we've passed on the idea of dinner, and we're just going to do a scotch tasting at my house. Is there a way that I can surprise them and make haggis? Graham, yeah, I think I can help. You're a brave soul, but this can be done with some work. Now, I've only got 7 minutes to do this explanation, so if you're going to need more tips, just reach out to me at info@drinkeatlearn.com. For those of you uninitiated with Robert Burns or a Burns dinner, here's what we're going to talk about. Burns Night, celebrated January 25th, honors Scotland's greatest poet, Robert Burns, usually with poetry readings and whiskey toast and a hearty plate of haggis and something called neeps and tatties. Traditionally, haggis is presented with bagpipes playing and someone recites this poem, and it's very dramatic, right? Robert Burns is also known for writing Auld Lang Syne. That's the song that we sing at the stroke of midnight on New Year's. So most of us unknowingly recite one of these guys' poems, even if we don't even know the guy. Burns dinners are a huge thing in Scotland, and I've had the honor of not only cooking for a traditional Burns dinner, I've paired some amazing scotches as a former whiskey associate for Glenfiddich. Okay, Graham, let's talk about haggis. Haggis is this savory dish made from organ meats, oats, spices, and beef fat. Think of it as Scotland's answer to meatloaf just stuffed in a sheep's lung and boiled for 3 hours. So let's tackle the original recipe quickly, and then we'll go over the modern recipe for haggis. I'm going to leave recipes for both original and my modern take with Jack. You can always rewind the show, and you can have the ingredients on hand as we tackle these tips on how to do this. So original haggis is sheep's heart, liver, lungs, and kidneys. You got onions, beef fat, steel-cut oats, and some seasonings in there. You basically take all that and stuff it into a sheep's stomach. So first off, you're going to need to find a good butcher, and telling them what you're planning is key. They'll probably need to order a lot of these items, but in this instance, let's just roll with the idea that you got all these random sheep parts and you're ready for this recipe. First up, you got to clean your sheep's stomach. If your butcher's good, they can help, but you'll need to clean it more. Warm water, kosher salt, salt, scrub, 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 soak, rinse and repeat, rinse and repeat. Is it worth it? Well, if you think about what was in there previously, yeah, it's worth it. Take the time to clean your stomach again. Next, you're going to toast some steel-cut oats and some beef fat until it's golden brown. It's a little step, but it adds this really nice nutty complexity. Once it's done, just set it aside, let it cool. Then you're going to take all of your heart, liver, lungs, and kidneys and onions, and I just grind all this up. I prefer to grind it based on the final cook and texture. It just works out better if you grind all the same consistency. When I'm ready to build this and mix it together, I take some of my beef stock that I have or lamb stock that I have, and I add it a little bit at a time. I don't want this to get too wet. And once it's mixed, I'll throw it in the fridge overnight. I'll let it bind together even more, or I'll even freeze it if I know I have a dinner coming up. And when you're ready for all of this and everything's, you know, mixed together, you're going to take your sheep's stomach and you're going to take this meat mixture and you're going to start packing it into your stomach. A tip I've learned over the years is not to overstuff the stomach. During the cooking, it tends to swell and it can rupture. Take some kitchen twine and I essentially sew the stomach closed. I get a big pot, enough water to submerge the stomach, and I bring it to a simmer. Do not boil. I simmer this for about 3 hours. I pull it, let it cool for about 10 minutes, and then I slice it. Another tip, I usually take the meat mixture before I stuff, and I take a couple ounces and I pan fry it. And I do this just to taste it. It's easier to adjust your seasoning before you stuff and cook. Again, that took a lot of years to figure that one out. Listen, haggis is not pretty. Is it delicious? Again, that's up for you to decide. Worth the effort? It's fun, and it's a really cool thing to learn the traditional way they do it. But let's talk about my modern style and why this can be so much easier and it still honors the flavors appropriately. Yes, if you want, you can use the same ingredients as the original recipe, but most of us don't have a ton of sheep organ meat lying around. So in my adaptation, I use 100% beef organ meat. Beef organs are easier to order from a butcher, and depending on your specialty grocery store, might even be available without ordering. Haggis is a potent, intense, organ-flavored dish, but I actually prefer the beef organ recipe over the original. Now, for the most important change that makes this much easier is I do not use sheep's stomach. I actually make haggis links. You'll basically get the same effect with this technique. I've just never felt sheep's stomach added anything to the flavor of haggis. Historically, it was used because it was cheap and practical. Now, I feel it's more for just like tradition and shock value at the presentation. But I prefer using collagen sausage casings. Based on the time today, now is not the time to go over on how to stuff your sausage casings. Graham, you've got a lot of work to do before Saturday. Jack has a great episode, The Art of Making Sausage, episode 3584. I urge you to listen to this and gain some tips on how to stuff things. If you don't have an electric stuffer, you can do it by hand. It won't look pretty, but it'll work and it'll keep things looking rustic. And now would be a good time to recommend the Vivor electric sausage stuffer on T-Spaz. So in my modern technique, I also like to vacuum seal my haggis sausage links, and then I sous vide them at 165 for about 3 hours. When it's time to eat, I saute these links for a couple of minutes to get a little color and a little crispiness. I really love these haggis links. Remember, you can use the traditional ingredients or the beef variation in the sausage link. Just lose the sheep stomach. Okay, lastly, the sides. Neeps. Neeps are mashed turnips or rutabagas with butter, salt, and pepper. Don't overthink this. Grab some, peel them, boil them, mash them. You're good to go. Tatties. Tatties are mashed potatoes. I'm not giving you a recipe for mashed potatoes. I think you got that. Finally, though, is whiskey gravy. Now, basically, this is beef or lamb stock gravy made with a roux, and then you add a couple of tablespoons of scotch to finish. The Scottish like to ladle a little bit of this gravy over the haggis. Haggis has been a mystery to most. It's tons of organ meat, so lots of people just don't care for it. I do like haggis on special occasions, like a burned supper. I always find it actually tastes better when I'm about 5 to 6 drams into a good space-sized scotch. I'm going to leave some scotch pairings for the Burns dinner on drinkeatlearn.com, as well as some classic poems that you should read if you really want to keep this traditional. I wish you the best of luck, Graham. I know this is a pretty obscure request and a question, but I definitely wanted to get you pointed in the right direction. Keep those questions rolling in. This has been Ken at drinkeatlearn.com. Cheers.
Not sure I'm ever going to be down with haggis personally. Just I'll try anything. I would never put the effort in just to try it, though, like to make it myself. But my gut is I'm not going to care for this. I've had similar types of foods that I do not care for. Something far less out there for a lot of people, and I was recently asked about this, is a Scrapple. You know, I grew up in Pennsylvania, Dutch country. Have you ever had Scrapple? Yes. And do you like it? No, I don't. And I've had it made several, you know, like several different recipes and stuff. If I had to eat it or starve, I would eat it, but I would never order it or ask for it by name, right? So that's kind of how I expected I would feel about a haggis as well. And again, Scrapple is kind of like gray Spam in some ways, so I thought, I just don't care for it. All right, next up, let's talk about you. You work for an employer, you leave the employer, you have a 401k, it can stay there. Should you roll to an IRA and why if you should? John Puglion will answer that. Also saving money for your child's future without getting roped into something like a 529 plan.
Hello, TSP. We have a couple investing questions. First one comes from Sean. His question is rolling over a 403B from a previous employer into a traditional IRA so I have more investing options a good idea? Well, Sean, I really think it is a good idea. The way I look at the constraints that are put on most employer-type programs, whether it's a 401k or a 403b, unless your employer is offering an extremely flexible plan, then generally, in my opinion, I think the only reason you put money into an employer plan is to get the match, because they are so restricted in what they allow you to invest in, where you can move your money to, and what type of choices you have for individual investments. So think of an employer-sponsored retirement investing program like the health insurance they offer you. You know, unfortunately, the way our tax system and our health insurance are set up, virtually all employees are forced to have health care through their employer. Well, if it was up to you and you could go out and choose in a free market environment what type of health insurance policies you wanted to purchase, and there was all that competition for your dollars, don't you think that you could put together a better health insurance program than the one that your employer forces you and crams down your throat? In a lot of ways, I think that's a very good analogy to the way employer-sponsored retirement plans are forced upon employees. The good news, though, is that once you leave an employer, unlike your health insurance, you can take the funds in there and roll them over to some type of an individual retirement account. And because the retail investment environment is so large, you can take that IRA and move it into a discount broker where you can purchase, you know, virtually anything that's traded in stock markets, whether it's stocks or bonds or ETFs or mutual funds. And if you're unhappy with that discount broker or its services, you can simply transfer it to an IRA at another discount broker. And you can not only just have one IRA account, you could have multiple IRA accounts at multiple discount brokers or banks or credit unions. Or for that matter, you could administer it yourself if you wanted to go through all those hassles and jump through those hoops. The other thing to keep in mind, Sean, is that rolling over into an IRA is a very simple process. You can do that yourself. You don't need an advisor to do it for you. The discount brokers want your business, and they've made it very convenient to roll the money over, and they will help you and guide you through the process if you want them to do it for you. So absolutely, other than the match that an employer is providing for you in their 401k or 403b program, I think in almost all cases, you're better off, once you leave employment, moving that into an IRA where you have 100% control. All right, next question comes from Joe. He wants to start saving money for his two kids. He doesn't want to put it in a 529 because he thinks that's too restrictive. He's done some research and he's learned about the Uniform Gift to Minors Act, and he's wondering if that's a better alternative. Well, yeah, Joe, I agree with you. I'm not a fan of the 529. They have gotten better with recent tax law. They now do allow a portion of any residual money left over or that's not used for education to be rolled into the student's Roth IRA. There are problems with that, though. It still potentially could open you up to issues with state tax if you received tax credits for that during the initial contribution. There's also some gray areas as to how rolling that into a Roth would affect the actual ability to contribute to a Roth for that particular year. In any case, I still am not a big fan of the 529s. But getting to your point, Uniform Gift to Minors Act, something similar but different is the Uniform Transfer to Minors Act. Bottom line, for tax purposes, I'm not giving you any advice here. Talk to a tax professional. But in terms of saving for your children's future, yeah, the advantage to something like this is that you can open up a custodial account in your child's name with you as the trustee. This can be a bank account or this could be a brokerage account. and there are no restrictions on what the money is used for. Generally, any gains are going to be taxed at the child's income, which would probably provide a tax benefit to you. I think the only real negatives are, number one, down the road, if your child would apply for some type of a grant to go to school, they would have to report this as their assets. To me, that's not such a big deal. I generally encourage people not to plan on getting government grants anyways. The other negative about it, and most people don't consider this, I've seen enough problems over the years that I do have a concern with it, and that's that, especially if it's a large amount of money, you know, down the road after you've been doing this for 10, 15 years, the child is in 100% control of that money on the day they become an adult. Now, depending upon how it's set up, that could be 18 years old or it could be 21 years old. The problem that I've seen over the years is that very oftentimes an 18-year-old can act irresponsibly if they have a great deal of money. Yeah, that should come as no surprise to anybody. Now, I'm sure you're raising really great kids, and that may not be an issue to you, but it should be something that you do think about. In any case, one way around that is to simply just save the money and keep it in your name or in a joint account in you and your wife's name. Now, the disadvantage there is that you don't get any kind of an added tax benefit because all the gains are going to be taxed at your regular capital gains rate. But the advantage is that you do maintain 100% control and sovereignty over your money. But the bottom line on this is that your bank or your discount broker, they don't care how many accounts you and your wife have. So you could open up two accounts, one for each of your kids. It would be in your name, right? I'm not talking about a joint account. It would be specifically either in your name or a joint account with your wife. Your child's name would be nowhere on the account. But you would just mentally earmark that the money in that account belongs to your son and the other account belongs to your daughter. That way, you've got the money separate. It's segregated. There's absolutely no restrictions on it. You can dole that out as you see fit. And for whatever reason, should your child grow up and not make good financial decisions, they just can't control that money. Hey, those are just my thoughts. I'll close out by saying this. The year is off to an interesting start as far as the stock market. You know, we have a new presidential administration. The Federal Reserve's interest rate policy has seemed to have shifted where they're higher rates for longer. There's all kinds of uncertainty about tariffs and executive orders. And just this past week, a lot of fear has come into the market in terms of artificial intelligence and the Chinese company, DeepSeek. Well, hey, I put out a couple episodes this week addressing some of those issues. I do plan to get more content out here in the near future as well. So if you want to hear my opinion on things, check those out. Hey, as always, thanks for the questions. Until next time, this is John Pugliano from Investable Wealth and the Wealth Setting Podcast.
I'm going to say, just when you're thinking about your kid's future and maintaining some control over money, at least to a certain age, that you put aside for them. It might be more important than you think. And this will be me being honest about what I was like in my 20s. I absolutely would put 80 hours of work in a week at two or sometimes even like three jobs, like two side hustles and one full-time job. I would absolutely do that. I was in, you know, if I go back to that time frame, I was in like the telecommunications industry. So there was a lot of exciting. I knew CATV, I knew data cabling, I knew voice. So there was a lot of ways that I could get extra work outside of my employer. And so, like, you know, go in and terminate a couple of fiber optic cables or go in and build a CATV plant for a private cable system. There's all kinds of things I could do, and I did it. So if you were looking at me, even as a parent, you'd have said, man, I can't fault the guy. Look at him work. Yeah, and I also blew money like a drunken sailor, right? I mean, I really did. I was always hanging out in bars. I was chasing girls. You know, I even worked part-time as a bouncer in a club for a while. And while I was on the clock, I couldn't drink. But then that just put me in the bar crowd. And when our bar closed, because we were in the Strike County, we went to another. I'm just saying I pissed money away. And the worst thing you could have done to that guy, if you never wanted him to get to where I eventually got, was handed him a big lump sum of money at that time. I don't know what I would have done, but I know it wouldn't have added to my walk and my path of financial maturity and responsibility. It was the very need to struggle that even when I was pissing that money away, realizing I put my blood and sweat into this money that's already gone, that made me change. If it had been granted to me, I probably would have worked less at the time and been even dumber. And so you have to be cautious with big chunks of money put away for children. I think it's great to invest in your child's future, but you should be not investing in your child's future. You should be investing in a young man or woman's future, and you should tie the ability for them to access that investment to their progression as they grow into man or womanhood, if that makes sense. All right, with that, let's go ahead, and we got one more before we have my segment. This from Doc Bones.
Hi, Joe Alton, MD here, also known as Dr. Bones of the survival website doomandbloom.net. Co-author of the Book Excellence Award-winning fourth edition of the Survival Medicine Handbook, the number one ranked book in emergency medicine on Amazon, and designer of quality medical kits at store.doomandbloom.net. Today's question comes from David, who writes, question for Doc Bones. We want to have a supply of IVF and IV catheters for emergencies. Do you have any recommendations? There have been times when we've needed IV fluids but did not have access except for an emergency room. In larger cities, you can have services come to your house, but this is not a possibility in rural or smaller towns. I have medical training, so starting IV fluids on my own is not a problem. However, I'm unsure of how to get the supplies and wonder if you have any tips. David, no, indeed, we do not sell IV fluids on our site, just to make that clear. But you're absolutely right. It's possible that you might encounter a person in shock who's in desperately need of fluids off the grid. IV hydration is certainly the best method of delivery in these cases, but normal saline and other types of fluids are prescription products and difficult to stockpile in any type of quantity for austere settings. You can get, let's say, a 500cc bag in a training kit, but getting cases and cases of it, which you would need as a survival medic, would be not so easy, let's face it. As well, given that a single liter of saline solution weighs a couple of pounds, carrying the amount of IV fluids that might make a difference in a major injury might be problematic if you're on foot. I shouldn't have to tell you that the lack of availability of IV options has been a frustration for me since I started writing about survival medicine. There is an option, however, that is available for austere settings, and that is rectal rehydration. That is also called proctolysis. That may be an option in situations where IV fluid and IV therapy in general is unavailable. The large intestine functions to absorb water, electrolytes, and vitamins, but not nutrients, leaving solid waste. It stands to reason that if the colon can absorb fluid introduced from above, it should be able to absorb it from below. Let's talk about what I call the Murphy drip. In the first decade of the 20th century, John Murphy, a Wisconsin surgeon, introduced a drip method of introducing salt solutions via the rectum. This was used in hospital units during World War I, and it received acceptance as just another tool in the medical woodshed. As intravenous fluid administration became more advanced, use of the method diminished and essentially became obsolete. I personally knew little about proctolysis, as it's rarely used in modern medicine. The difficulty that the average person would have obtaining IV fluids in a survival situation, however, made it pretty clear to me that an alternative fluid delivery system was needed for those unable to be orally hydrated. Indeed, it's the lack of availability of many medical items in times of trouble that first led me to write the original articles about fish antibiotics as a survival option many years ago. During my research, I found animal studies in the Journal of Emergency Medicine. In one study, rabbits were drained of blood until they were severely depleted. A tube was then inserted in their rectums and fluids administered, and this led to improvement of the vital signs used to monitor shock. Another study in 1998 used a procedure with tap water or saline solution in 78 terminally ill cancer patients with success. Further, in the Wilderness and Environmental Medicine Journal, a single case of shock at a remote high-altitude location was treated with proctolysis and improved the patient's status enough to allow evacuation. The benefit of rectal rehydration is the fact that sterilized water or oral rehydration solutions may be used effectively via the rectum to improve fluid status. This provides an inexpensive and readily available avenue when intravenous therapy isn't available. Now, to perform proctolysis on a patient, you'll need a number of items. They include the following: sterilized water, normal saline, oral rehydration salt solution. These are things that you can put together yourself. A number 22 nasogastric tube or a number 14 Foley urinary catheter with a 10 milliliter syringe. A reservoir container for the fluids, a bag in other words. Tubing to connect the reservoir container to the NG or Foley catheter. Gloves, wash your hands, right? And lubricant. a way to monitor the rate of infusion. In a 1998 study involving humans, the fluid was infused at a rate of 250 cc's per hour. You also need a way to secure the tube in place, a stand to place the reservoir at a level higher than the level of the patient, and equipment to monitor vital signs like blood pressure, pulse, respiration rate, things like that. Now, I've been thinking about this, and I think there are a number of other points to consider regarding rectal rehydration, and they include that the fluids used should be warm to normal body temperature to prevent hypothermia. That's the excessive lowering of body temperature. The patient should be placed on their left side to decrease drainage from the rectum and increase absorption. If the patient is conscious, you want to be sure to discuss the method of procedure and its purpose beforehand, and you need to closely monitor vital signs throughout the procedure. Now, with regards to the nasogastric tube, that can be inserted further into the large intestine than the Foley catheter, which might result in improved absorption. The Foley catheter, however, can prevent much of the leakage that you may find with the NG tube because Foleys have an inflatable balloon that acts as sort of a plug that doesn't allow it to come out. In the cases cited, the NG was inserted about 15 inches while the Foley catheter was inserted about 5 to 8 inches and then pulled back gently until the balloon met resistance. Remember that excessive pressure on the rectum from the Foley balloon can cause trauma. You have to be prepared to deal with drainage, which can be messy, and an enema effect may be observed, especially if high volumes of fluids are given too quickly. If this happens, you want to stop the proctolysis immediately because the patient is actually losing fluids, not gaining them. Rectal rehydration should be avoided in cases of diarrhea as a hyperactive bowel may not adequately absorb fluids, and you have to remember the procedure can be uncomfortable. It's not a feeding method. There's evidence that it's been used as torture, as a matter of fact, throughout history. It's important to know that you should never try this or any other medical procedure if there is modern medical help available. Keep this method of rehydration in reserve only for post-apocalyptic, austere, or very remote settings. This is Joe Alton, MD, that old Dr. Bones, wishing you the best of health in good times or bad. Thanks for listening. Hey, Family Medic, don't forget to check out the many one-of-a-kind quality medical kits in our entire line at store.doomandbloom.net. And don't forget to get your copy of the Book Excellence Award-winning 4th edition of the Survival Medicine Handbook, the essential guide for when help is not on the way. You'll be glad you did.
So, since he's the doctor, I'll let all his advice speak for itself, and I don't really have anything to add on to what he said. What I do have to add on, though, is about hydration services and how valuable it is to know if they're available, how long the response time is, and if they're available in your area. And so we have several in Dallas-Fort Worth. Again, we're a big city, and even though we live outside the city, we are serviced by just about all of them. And when COVID came around, my wife got COVID about 10 months into the whole fiasco. And I did too at the same time. We all got it. The whole family got it. It is what it is. And for me, it was literally no big deal. I felt weird. I knew something wasn't right. If COVID hadn't been a thing, if we had just like rocked on with life and assumed it was some sort of cold or flu, like we probably would have done 30 years prior to when it happened, I would have thought, I got some weird thing, and I would have just went on with my life. My wife, who was different, she got a very, very sore throat. Due to that, she became dehydrated, and we figured that out when her blood pressure got as low as it did, and she started feeling lightheaded. And that's when she finally told me she wasn't drinking, and I'm like, no, you have to drink. So we sent her to the doctor. The doctor gave her steroids to bring down the swelling in her throat, but she had already been to the doctor by the time we realized she was dehydrated. And again, she just didn't tell me, and I guess she didn't tell the doctor either. And as soon as I realized she's dehydrated, I knew about these things. So I got one set up. From the time I hit order to the guy knocking on our door was 35 minutes. He was a really cool dude. He was a combat medic that took the job during COVID because he wasn't afraid to go out and do it. And he came in. He was at our house for maybe 15 minutes. He was a joy to talk to while he was doing his job. When he got done, my wife went to sleep like he had given her a sedative, and I let her sleep, and I knew what it was. She could sleep because she was relaxed. She got up, and from that point, it was straight away like she was like me after that. She was fine. It was no big deal. Why I say this is so important, you never know what's going to happen. You never know what's going to happen. And had I taken her to the ER, in the best case scenario, it would have took 3 or 4 hours before she would have had fluids given to her. She may never have gotten fluids delivered to her because fluids aren't treatment for COVID. I understand, sure, okay, yeah. But, you know what fluids are a treatment for? dehydration. That's what they're for. And is this true? I spoke to, after this happened, a paramedic who had to go to the ER he worked out of three times before they would give him fluids, and he knew he was dehydrated. What chance would you have had? There's a lot of use for being able to give somebody fluids. It's a very simple thing to do. A trained professional can do it in a way that poses no risk. The hydration company we found also will do things like add certain vitamins and things like that. So if you have something going around or you've just got it, you can kind of beef things up before it's full on. That's another advantageous thing. And there are several people that I've talked to now who work really hard outdoor jobs in the summer, and they have this done, let's say, you know, Sunday afternoon when they're going to go back to work Monday, and they have this done weekly through the hottest part of the year just to kind of beef up their resilience, and they've had really good results from it. So I'm not saying everybody should do that. I'm saying it's good to know about. Now let's talk about my segment today, which is about AI. And I'll just throw something out really quick out of the gate. I still get some of you, special kids, telling me how evil it is, it's going to take over the world, blah, 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 blah. Look, if you want to ignore this, go ahead. If you bring it to me, I'm going to tell you that you are hurting yourself the way I've always told you you're hurting yourself when you do that. So back in 2013, I started telling you about Bitcoin, and I got the same shit. And I said, you can do what you want, but all you're doing is preventing yourself from eventually becoming a millionaire with very small investments over time. That's what happened. Okay, so here I'm going to tell you another Jack Spirko young man story. About mid-90s, same time I was just talking about, I ended up with a job where they gave me a pager. Because I might be in New Orleans one day and then be there for like a week, and then I think I'm going home, but no, you got to go to San Antonio, that type of thing. So they would page me, and a dispatcher would tell me where I had to go to, so I had a pager. When I left that job and got a local job where I didn't have to travel anymore, they also gave me a pager, and that way, if I was needed or something, I could make a call. I was so anti-phone that I was unwilling to pay for a landline at my apartment. And, like, if somebody needed me, they would page me. And if I was at the office, I would just pick one of the lines up at the office and call them. If I was at home, I would go, I was in an apartment, and there was, like, just breakdown and around the back of the building were a bank of payphones. And I would call them from a payphone because I wasn't going to give the phone company, like, $60, I think it was, for the deposit before I even had a bill. I'm like, this is stupid. I'm not doing it. Okay? So I was pretty anti-phone. And I remember at that time of my life, like, if I went to a mall, because malls were still a thing, there would be a guy outside of Radio Shack with a cell phone trying to get you to sign up for a cell phone. And I remember telling those people, you see this? And hold my pager up. This already has more people bothering me than I want to be bothered by. That's the last thing I need in my life. A couple years later, I was running, you know, a division of a company, and I couldn't have done it without a cell phone. And today, like most people, I use my cell phone more for all of the peripheral technology than I do for the phone part. I bet you I do not use 50 minutes a month of talk time. But I sure use my phone. It's for video. It's for photography work. It's all the apps. It's everything else on it. You know, it's integrated with my computer systems, etc. And it was just an inevitability that anybody would end up there. Like, there's almost nobody that doesn't have that technology today. Very, very few. And those that don't have it are at a strategic disadvantage to those that do. Okay? AI is going to be that times 10. You're going to be, I don't care what you do, you're going to have people competing in your space against you who do know how to use it. And the productivity gain is such that you cannot afford to allow that to happen. Your argument is it can be used for evil. That is the same argument that gun grabbers use as to why you shouldn't have a fucking gun. And you're smart enough to be like, you know, the fact that it can be used for evil, but I can own one and use it for good, is actually the reason I should have a gun. It's the same shit. So, if your enemy has a pew delivery device that can be used against you, you need a pew delivery device to protect you from your enemy. That's where I'm coming from. This new tool, Notebook LM. I put out like a still shot video today, like kind of like this podcast is on YouTube. And I do intros to them when I'm going to keep doing this. And I'm going to do intros to them that says what it is. I don't want anybody to be deceived by what I'm putting out, though I think right now you can kind of figure out it is AI, sort of. And that's kind of the two voices in it have like an NPR vibe to me more than an AI vibe. But what this tool allows you to do is you take your own sources and you put them in. They can be PDFs, they can be web links, etc. You drop them in, you drop as many as you want. I think it's up to like the free version is up to like 500 sources. Now, I don't know if that's cumulative of all your projects or per project. I'm not sure. But I don't see needing that many, and I could delete the project, so I don't know that I'll ever pay for it until it's more than just more sources. There'll have to be more features like different voices and more control over the output and stuff. Then we'll look at it. What this does is it will immediately eliminate one of the biggest problems people have with AI, which is bias. Since it's only operating on the sources you give it, if you give it sources that are super liberal, it's going to give you super liberal content. If you give it sources that are just full-on academic, it's going to give you blatantly academic. And if you give it sources that are conservative, it'll give you that. Whatever you give it, it will give you back. And this is not about having the right prompts or something. You literally are, you're giving it the material you want it to make a conversation about. Once you do that, you can actually interact with it through a chatbot similar to ChatGPT, but it will only be able to pull from the sources you gave it. So it's great for like test prep. If you have an electronic copy of a textbook, you can drop it in there and use it. It will create an FAQ for you. It will create a study guide for you. But the coolest part of it is it will do this output, you know, of a podcast-style conversation between a male voice and a female voice. And they will do it just like a podcast. Now, again, to me, it feels a lot like an NPR-style podcast. Oh, that's great. Like, remember Fresh Air from Saturday Night Live? Welcome to Fresh Air. I think Molly Shannon was part of that. It's not that bad, but it's in that vibe, right? So I'd prefer to have different voices, have the dude maybe sound a little more masculine, the chick a little less chippy. But it's a good way to gain exposure. And I want to tell you some of the things you can do with it that you may not think of. Like, yes, you can make a podcast with it and put it out. I actually listen to a podcast that's built with this exact tool. And I can tell it is because it's the same voices. It's on Biochar. And it's from a company that curates a bunch of articles every week and then wraps them into a podcast. I don't have time to read the articles. So, like today, I made one about AI. So I looked up in Google News, you can run a Google News search and you can determine, I only want to see articles that came out in the last 24 hours, last week, whatever. And then you narrow that search however you want and you pull all the ones that are interesting. You drop the links into this thing. You hit the output, and you end up with, you know, a 20, 30-minute podcast discussion about all those articles in a conversational format. I think you can see the value of this. So, like, if you want to learn about one subject a day, what's going on in it, you can build one of these things for yourself in about 5 minutes. Then it'll take, you know, 10, 15 minutes to generate the podcast, but you don't have to do anything. And when it's ready, you can work, throw your earbuds on, whatever, and hit play. And while you're multitasking, you can get this overview of the content you want. And again, if you're using it for study in school, it will create a study guide for you. You can use the chatbot to have it create sample exams. This is off the hook. Now, this is what I mean by I don't care what you do. Your competition is going to use this type of technology. Imagine you're trying to get into a school, and there's an exam for that school, and half of the students are using this to help prepare for that exam, and you're not. You're more likely not to get into the school. That's just one example. What kind of grades will you be getting? Think of the student who adapts this technology to integrate the learning into their other activities of their life when they can multitask, competing with the student who doesn't. And as student outcomes go up in schools, I know there's a lot of bullshit in schools right now, but that's changing too. It's going to become more competitive. I think a lot of the fake degrees are going to go away and whatnot. And as students rapidly progress through curriculum, the curriculum will become itself more rigorous. So again, I'm back to, you can ignore this like it's all going to go away. Or you can be afraid of it because I don't know, what do you think, it's going to take over your brain? Right? And what was ironic, and I would say you probably should listen to the one I did today, was to listen to AI talk about the dangers of AI going too far. That was kind of cool. So I'll put in the show notes for today in the audio. Again, there's a link if you're listening to the video. right under my bullet point where it says, what have I learned using Notebook LM for a few days, links to those two videos. If you're on YouTube right now, go to my channel. You can find them in under videos. But one is from the Bill Mollison lecture series, and one is from this AI curation. And I've done other things. Yesterday, I didn't share it, and I don't think I'm going to, but I built one on aquaculture. And I'm playing with it. I'm learning things. Like, when I built the aquaculture one, it started talking about diversity and inclusion because it was mentioned in one of the articles. I just killed it, and I redid the instructions and said, I want you to ignore that. And when it made the new version, it did. Because they were talking, let me tell you why, too. It's not just me hating diversity and DEI shit, because I do. But the story that it was inserted into, you know, was clearly written by somebody with that agenda. But it was about fish farming in Norway. Do you know how much diversity, equity, and inclusion is going on with fish farmers in northern Norway? None. They're all a bunch of white guys because that's who lives there. And that's who does that work. So you can actually prune out shit with proper prompts in the final prompt before you generate it if you want to. So I think it's a really cool tool. Again, it's made by Google. You can use it for free. It saves your projects until you delete them. It's super intuitive. One thing to know, sometimes you'll drop a link into a website, and it's not paywalled. There's some other protection on it, and it prevents itself from being imported. Some people do that to prevent scraping, for instance. There's certain little lines of code you can put on the back end of your HTML to do that. If that's the case and you really want that source, you can cut and paste all the text and drop it in. You can still use it, right? All right. So with that, let's go ahead and wrap things up. I want to remind you guys that you can help me out by doing your online shopping at tspaz.com. Again, we have that Dynomyco mycorrhizal fungi inoculant on the website in the show notes today. But all the other stuff to get your garden off the ground for 2025. Next week, our items today will feature some other things. I'll finally be bringing you the review people have been asking for about the AeroPress coffee press. Yeah, I finally broke down and got one, and yeah, I should have done it a long time ago. The other thing you can do is become a member of the MSB. You get discounts on all kinds of stuff. Last night, I put in an order with Acura Botanicals using my own discount code that they gave us for my members. I saved $66 last night. I made one order. I saved $66. My membership is $50. You see what I'm saying? If you'll use the products that we have discounts for, if you're buying stuff out of that section of society anyway, self-sufficiency, self-reliance, independence, liberty, gardens, tactical, cannabis products, you know, distilling products, all the stuff we talk about anyway, you will get your money back. I had an email yesterday. The guy said he did the math. He was deciding, do I want to, like, he's going through doing, like, do I need this Netflix subscription, doing all that shit. Finds the TSP subscription. Says, I wonder how well this worked out for me. He did a back-of-the-napkin computation. He said he profited over $500 last year just using discounts from MSB. So if you're not a member yet, consider becoming one. And I'll let you know, I'm probably next week or the week after, don't join today is what I'm about to say. I'm probably going to run a sale. I might actually sell like 10 lifetime memberships. I have not done that for almost 2 years. So usually when I do that, they're $300 one time. You're a lifetime member. There's some other little perks that come with it. Not anything huge, but it's a way you can support the show and never have a membership fee again. People, I think when I first started, they'd be like, are you going to be around that long or whatever? And we've been here 16 years and I ain't going nowhere, baby. Who would hire me now? Okay, I'm going to do this shit until I'm retired, whenever that is, right? Because, and I just talked to John and Nicole this week about retirement. Like, I don't even know what that looks like for me. I think retirement for me is like 2 shows a week instead of 5. I think that's what that is. Anyway, so we're going to be around a long time, and it is an investment in the future, and do consider becoming. I'll throw one other thing out about membership. I launched my membership in 2009, $50 a year. My membership price in 2025 is $50 a year. I have never raised the price. I have no intentions to do it anytime soon. And I think it would be a hell of a value at twice the payment if you use the discount codes. Anyway, thank you for tuning in today. I will catch you tomorrow with that Friday flashback. And then next week, we'll do it all over again. And in my little project I've been doing with AI, with Josh Hale, unrelated to what I just talked about, my prompt today led me to something that we're going to do either Monday or Tuesday, and it won't be AI related directly. We're going to have a show next week, either Monday or Tuesday, called Living Outside the Matrix. Don't miss that one. It's going to be awesome. You they said you should have a house the American way. Dollar down, a dollar a month, and you never have to pay. There's a better way to do this. Let me show you a better way.